But we also saw that this isn't something for us to be embarrassed about. In fact, it's the key to understanding the message of the book of Esther. The characters in the book of Esther and the first readers of the book were God's people living in exile. God was not speaking directly to them the way he had done to his people in the past. Neither was God working among them in any obviously miraculous way. And God's people were faced with the question, does God still care about us? Is he still interested? Is he still working? And so the writer of Esther presents these historical events as they would have appeared to God's people. He presents them in an ambiguous way. There's no mention of God. No mention that God is orchestrating events. So are these events just coincidences? Or do they point to a sovereign God who is working out his purposes? And as the writer presents this material, he's saying to his readers, you have the scriptures. You know what they tell you about God. You answer the question, does God still care about us? Is he still interested? Is he still working? And we also notice that the situation of the characters in Esther and the situation of the first readers of Esther is not too different from our situation today. We are, in a real sense, aliens in this world. We live here, but we belong in heaven. And we also live in a time and a place where we may often wonder, is God at work? Is he concerned about us? Has he abandoned us? And then last week we turned to the text of Esther. And we saw that although on the surface, chapters 1 and 2 tell us that the Persian king Xerxes is in control, in fact the writer is asking us, but is that really true? And after looking at those chapters, we tried to sum up their message by saying even the most powerful rulers of this world do not have control of their own destinies, let alone the destiny of God's people. In chapter 2, we were introduced to two members of God's people, Mordecai and his adopted daughter Esther, who rose to become queen of Persia. And chapter 2 ended with Mordecai saving the king's life. But we notice something very curious. Historians tell us that normally, acts of loyalty to the Persian king were rewarded generously and immediately. But somehow, Mordecai's act of loyalty is overlooked. He didn't receive a reward. Now, later, that will become a very significant detail in the story. But as we begin chapter 3 this morning, the fact that Mordecai has not been honored is highlighted because we're told that someone else has been honored by the king. And in chapter 3, we see that an ancient enemy rises to threaten God's people. I'm sorry I don't have the page number in your church Bibles, but it's Esther chapter 3. An ancient enemy rises to threaten God's people. I'll begin at verse 1. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the poor, that is, the lot,
in the presence of Haman to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar.
Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman and attracts Haman's wrath. We aren't told why Xerxes honored Haman, but whatever the reason was, Haman is now in a position where he is to be honored by everyone else. And the way they're to show this is by bowing down to him. Now, there's no suggestion here that the people were being asked to worship Haman. In the cultures of the time, bowing in the presence of a superior was an accepted way to honor that person. So, for example, in the book of Genesis, Abraham bowed down to the Hittites to show them his respect. At the end of Genesis, Joseph's brothers bowed to him to show their respect. And Moses bowed to his father-in-law, Jethro. In none of those cases does the Bible condemn what happened. So bowing to a superior wasn't too different from curtsying or bowing to the queen today. If we do that, we aren't saying, I worship you. We're saying, I give you respect and honor because of your position. So with that in mind, we have to ask, why wouldn't Mordecai bow? Was it arrogance? Was his pride hurt because the king had honored Haman and Mordecai had been overlooked? In fact, the answer lies in what we're told about Haman. He's introduced to us in verse 1 as Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. And in case we missed that little detail the first time, it's repeated for us in verse 10 of this chapter, and twice in chapter 8, and twice in chapter 9. Clearly, it's an important detail, and the writer doesn't want us to miss it. And to understand why it's important, we have to begin way back at the Exodus from Egypt. When God delivered his people from slavery in Egypt, he brought them across the Red Sea, and they headed for Mount Sinai. But before they got there, they were attacked by a people called the Amalekites. And we read about it in Exodus chapter 17. The Amalekites were nomads and raiders. And no doubt they thought these newly escaped slaves would be easy meat. But their attack was also highly symbolic. The crossing of the Red Sea represented the formation of God's people. God had claimed these people for himself. Now they were his special people. And the first people they come into contact with attack them. God has redeemed these people for himself. And an attack on God's special people constitutes an attack on God himself. By attacking Israel, the Amalekites have become the enemies of God. Now, not surprisingly, the Amalekites were defeated in the battle that took place. And the account in Exodus ends by telling us this: the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. And a generation later, when God's people are finally poised to enter the land that God has promised them, God reminds them in the book of Deuteronomy, "Remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt. When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey and cut off all who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you in the land he is giving you to possess as an inheritance, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget." The Amalekites are the enemies of God and his people. And later still, when God's people are in the land of Canaan, God gives them a king, Saul. And God gives Saul the task of destroying the Amalekites. They are the enemies of God and his people. But Saul does not complete the mission. In the book of 1 Samuel chapter 15, we're told that he spared the king of the Amalekites, whose name was Agag. God then rejected Saul as king for the specific reason that he had been disobedient in this matter. He had not completed the mission against the enemies of God and his people. Now, no doubt this incident was lodged in the minds of all God's people from then on, but Mordecai had particular reason to remember it. When Mordecai was introduced to us in chapter 2, we were told that he was from the tribe of Benjamin, the same tribe as King Saul. Now, with that background in mind, Haman's introduction in the book of Esther takes on a whole new significance. Here is a descendant of Agag, the king of the Amalekites. No wonder Haman will not, in fact, cannot honor him. Haman is a representative of the ancient enemy of God and his people. And yet we might think Mordecai's reaction is a bit harsh on Haman. After all, surely he can't help his ancestry. But in fact, we soon find out that Haman shares his ancestors' desire to wipe out God's people. Look again at verse 5.
When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole region, kingdom of Xerxes.
Haman's reaction to Mordecai's defiance is out of all reasonable bounds. And it suggests he had been just waiting for a chance to go after God's people. Mordecai's defiance has given him the impetus that he needs. Clearly, Haman wants universal respect and honor, and he knows he won't get it from God's people, so they must be destroyed. And verse 7 tells us that Haman had some people cast the poor to determine when this destruction was to take place. Poor is the singular of Purim, and Purim were almost identical to our modern dice. They were clay cubes with either characters or dots on them. And as scholars have studied how the Purim were used, they disagree over whether they were used mainly for divine guidance or just as a form of chance. And whichever was the case, it doesn't alter the picture here very much. Haman believes he's either submitting himself to the will of the pagan gods or into the hands of fate. But the first readers of this book knew differently. They knew that the book of Proverbs says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." In one sense, Haman and Xerxes may have great power. They may be able to affect people's lives for better or for worse. But neither of them are in ultimate control. The Lord is. So the dice were cast in the months of Nisan, the first month of the year. And the day of destruction, we're told, was set for the month of Adar, the 12th month. But how is Haman going to carry out his plan? Verse 8.
Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all other people, and who do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business." So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. "Keep the money," the king said to Haman, "and do with the people as you please."
Notice that Haman doesn't tell Xerxes which people he wants destroyed. In verse 8, he just calls them a certain people. There's no evidence that Xerxes was a particularly bloodthirsty ruler. There's no evidence that he had any kind of agenda against certain people groups. And so notice how Haman presents his request. First, he says the people he has in mind are dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. In other words, they're everywhere, Xerxes. And second, they're a poison. Their customs are different from those of all other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. Therefore, at the end of verse 8, it is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. Haman is implying that they're revolutionaries, and they may spread their influence until they're able to rise up and overthrow Xerxes. Now, quite obviously, Haman is making a ridiculous claim. The Jews were a relatively small nation. And yes, under the kingship of David and Solomon, they had exercised power and influence way beyond their size. But that was centuries before this. And now the nation was broken and spread so thinly in exile that they were no threat at all. But Haman is playing here on Xerxes' pride and his insecurity. Xerxes wants to be everyone's highest authority. And he also senses how fragile his hold on power is. Of course, Haman is correct that God's people have distinct customs. And yes, Mordecai defied the king's order to bow to Haman. But Mordecai also saved the king's life. Mordecai and his people were not rebels against authority. They were not revolutionaries. Their faithfulness to God was no threat to King Xerxes. But Xerxes is proud, and he's fearful. And Haman has successfully played on his pride and his fear. Xerxes hands power over to Haman, symbolized by giving him his ring. And he even refuses Haman's offer to sweeten the deal with a vast amount of cash. And this tactic of portraying allegiance to God as a threat to society is alive and well today. For example, Professor Richard Dawkins is not content with arguing that Christians are wrong. He wants to convince his readers that Christians are dangerous. They aren't just stupid, they're a menace to society. And they ought not to be tolerated. In fact, even some atheists have noted that his hatred of Christianity seems to be beyond all reasonable bounds. And this mention of Professor Dawkins helps us to see the wider application of this passage. The book of Esther shows us how the age-old enemy of God's people manifested himself in one historical situation. We've seen that Haman was a descendant of Agag. And since the Exodus, Agag's people, the Amalekites, have been enemies of God and his people. At various times in history, a new representative of the Amalekites would rise to threaten God's people. And Haman is just the latest in that line. But Scripture tells us that the true enemy of God's people is not really the Amalekites. It's not really the descendants of Agag. Yes, at certain points in history, they appear as representatives of the enemy. But the true enemy of God's people was around before the Amalekites. Back in Genesis chapter 3, a serpent deceived God's first people, Adam and Eve. And God said that as a result, there would be perpetual enmity between their descendants and the descendants of the serpent. And the New Testament tells us that behind that serpent stood the devil himself, Satan. The serpent in the garden was his representative. And so as history progressed, and one enemy after another rose to threaten God's people, each new enemy was just another representative of that one great enemy, Satan. As each representative was defeated, eventually another would rise to take its place. And so the line that began with the serpent continued through the Amalekites and through King Agag. And here in Esther, Haman rises as the next representative of the enemy. And the New Testament book of Revelation tells us that until the end of history, the same old enemy will keep rising up. When one of his representatives is defeated, another will take his place to threaten God's people again. Earlier in the service, we heard from Revelation chapter 13. And in that passage, the enemy of God and his people is described as a dragon. And his representative is described as a beast. We're told that the beast had received a fatal wound. but the wound had been healed. But if a wound is fatal, how can it heal? Is that not a contradiction? Well, the point being made that as one historical representative of the great enemy is destroyed, another takes his place. The wound was fatal, but it healed. And Revelation 13 tells us that the beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. The same old enemy keeps coming back. And listen to how the situation in the book of Esther is one historical example of the description in Revelation 13. Xerxes has handed power over to Haman. And now we read in verse 12 of Esther chapter 3.
Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by the couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that they would be ready for that day. Spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered.
The beast has come back. The ancient enemy has risen to threaten God's people again. Theoretically, Xerxes is still in charge, but he's under the control of the enemy's representative, Haman. And what about us? We don't face a Haman or a Nero or a Stalin or a Hitler or a Kim Jong-il. But we still see glimpses of the old enemy. Maybe in the hatred of a Richard Dawkins or a Philip Pullman. And we may yet see one of these enemies given power and authority in our place and time. And so how are we to respond? Well, how did God's people in the book of Esther respond? In chapter 4, we see how in the face of the enemy's wrath, God's people resolved to stand up and be counted, whatever the consequences. Chapter 4, verse 1.
When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes.
In our culture, this type of behavior would be very odd. We aren't given to public displays of emotion like this. But in certain cultures, even today, this would be a recognizable and usual way of showing grief. And certainly it was common in biblical times. But the writer doesn't just expect us to see this as normal. He wants to show us a link with another part of Scripture. Earlier in the service, we heard from the book of Joel. And through Joel, God warned of terrible things to come. But then in the passage Jan read for us, God tells his people how to respond. He says, "Return to me with all your heart, with fasting and weeping and mourning." Now, although in the NIV, Esther chapter 4, verse 3 reads fasting, weeping, and wailing, in the original, the wording is the same in both passages. And these are the only two verses in the Old Testament where these words occur together. And we might say, well, fine, but did the people not pray? They probably did pray. But as the writer of Esther records these events, he wants his readers to know that this fasting, weeping, and wailing was a turning to God. It was what God had called for through the prophet Joel. God's people were calling for the mercy of their gracious and compassionate God. And no doubt they were echoing the prayer God had called for later in that passage in Joel. Spare your people, O Lord. Do not make your inheritance an object of scorn, a byword among the nations. Why should they say among the peoples, where is their God? In the face of the enemy's wrath, God's people in the book of Esther turned to their God. And they did it very publicly. So publicly, in fact, that Esther tries to put a stop to it. Verse 4.
When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why.
There's a bit of ambiguity here. Verse 2 told us that no one wearing sackcloth was allowed to enter the palace. So was Esther sending clothes so that Mordecai could come in and tell her what was going on? Is she in great distress because she doesn't know what's upsetting Mordecai? Maybe. But given the way Esther reacts when she does hear from Mordecai, it's equally possible that her great distress is because Mordecai is drawing attention to himself. After all, wasn't he the one who had told her not to reveal that she was a Jew? But lately she's heard that he's been telling his work colleagues that he's a Jew. And now he's wailing loudly and bitterly outside the palace gates. So Esther may be trying to shut him up here. In any case, when Mordecai refuses the clothes, Esther sends Hathach to find out what's going on. Verse 6.
So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and to explain it to her. And he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and to plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king."
Esther is scared. And it's not hard to see why she's scared. At this point, she's been married to Xerxes for 5 years, and it seems that he's losing interest in her. He hasn't sent for her in 30 days. Mordecai is asking too much from her. She doesn't have the kind of clout to get away with going unsummoned to the king. She might lose everything, not just her crown, but her life as well. But Mordecai won't let her off the hook. Verse 12.
When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this?"
We saw last week that even Xerxes was not safe in the palace. And now Mordecai tells Esther that her position in the palace will not guarantee her safety. If and when her background becomes known, she will fall with the rest of God's people. And then in verse 14, Mordecai comes as close as this book gets to an explicit mention of God's sovereignty. You didn't rise to become queen by accident, Esther. You were put there so that when this happened, you would be in a position to act. This blessing you have received is not something to try to hold on to. It's not something to try to exploit for yourself. It was given to you so that when the time came, you could use it for the good of God's people. And notice the balance here between what theologians call divine sovereignty and human responsibility. God is absolutely sovereign. If Esther refuses her duty, deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. God's plans will not be thwarted. He will use another human agent. And yet that doesn't make Esther's decision unimportant. She has a responsibility to do what God has given her to do. She can't get off the hook by saying, well, someone else will step up. She has been put in her royal position for this moment. It is her responsibility to step up. And there's something else we shouldn't miss in these verses. It's Mordecai's amazing confidence that God's people will be delivered. Where did this come from? Chapter 3, verse 12, told us that the decree of destruction was written and sent out on the 13th day of the first month. And I'm sure that doesn't immediately mean anything to us. But according to the book of Exodus, the Passover feast was to be celebrated every year on the 14th day of the first month. So many of God's people would have received Haman's decree on Passover itself. And as you may remember, the annual Passover feast was a celebration, a memorial of the first Passover back in Egypt. On that night, God's people were delivered from certain death. Because of Pharaoh's stubborn rebellion against God, God had announced this through Moses. About midnight, I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn son of the slave girl who is at her handmill. And that's what happened. But not one of the Israelites died. Why? Because something else died in their place. God told his people to kill a lamb or a goat and paint some of the blood on the doorposts of their homes. God said, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Now, there was nothing magical about the blood. It was simply a sign that the people in the house had faith in God's promise. His promise to accept the death of the lamb or the goat in their place. The animal died as their substitute. And that night, God's people were saved from a decree of death. And obviously, God's people in the book of Esther were focused on that event at the very time they received Haman's decree. But we might still ask, why should that have given Mordecai such courage? And in fact, such certainty that God would deliver his people from this decree of death? We've mentioned that in the wake of Haman's decree, there seems to have been a turning back to God among God's people. And we saw that this was in line with what God called for in the book of Joel. Later in that chapter of Joel, God says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. As we noticed last week, God's people in exile had God's word. They knew about the book of Joel, and they know that Joel promised deliverance to all those who turned to God. God had kept his promise of deliverance back in Egypt. Surely he could be counted on to keep it again in Persia to all those who called out to him. And both of these references to God's deliverance help us to apply this to our own situation. How are we to respond when the ancient enemy rises up to threaten God's people? The first thing to do is make sure we are a part of God's people. Because as the end of the book of Esther will tell us, however awful the wrath of God's enemy may be, his ultimate doom is sure. And so is the doom of those who follow him. And those who are not part of God's people are following God's enemy. There's no middle ground on this issue. And so our passage from Joel is taken up again in the New Testament. In the book of Romans, Paul says that the risen Christ is Lord. And Paul says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. That's a promise. Those who put their faith in Jesus' death on the cross will be saved from eternal destruction. When we accept that Jesus died in our place as our substitute, then we have God's assurance that Satan will be thwarted in his plans to drag us to eternal death. We may feel the weight of the enemy's wrath here on earth, but when it comes to eternity, we can have even greater confidence than Mordecai had, because through Christ, deliverance has come. Well, Esther chooses to step up and do what she must do. Verse 15. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. She comes finally to the point of being willing to do what is right, whatever the consequences. In Revelation 13, after the description of the wrath of God's enemy, we read these words. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Scripture nowhere promises that God's obedient people will escape physical suffering and death. But Scripture does promise us that God is in control. Last week we finished with these words from the New Testament book of Romans. And they're helpful again today as we think about the message of Esther. In all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. And so this is the message of Esther chapters 3 and 4. When God's people are faced with the wrath of God's enemy, we must do what is right and leave the outcome in God's hands. When God's people are faced with the wrath of God's enemy, we must do what is right and leave the outcome in God's hands. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Martin Luther was a man who knew all about the wrath of God's enemy. And last week we sang quite an old translation of his hymn. And this week we're going to close by singing a newer translation of that hymn. It's in your praise hymn book, your blue hymn book, number 888. Our God stands like a fortress rock. 888.